Now, detonate the reality bomb!
Was the noted fiction writer, horror fiction writer, H.P. Lovecraft actually channeling something or tapping into something that later transformed or was taken and interpreted by occultist Kenneth Grant into and maybe I'm putting this incorrectly, but we'll put this to our guest, a more refined form of telema, building upon the work of Aleister Crowley. What are the connections between Lovecraft, Crowley, and Grant? That's the topic of A View from the Bunker tonight. I'm Derek Gilbert, our guest, the author most recently of Ratline, Soviet Spies, Nazi Priests, and the Disappearance of Adolf Hitler. Of course, the Sinister Forces trilogy, to which we refer quite often, and the subject of tonight's discussion, The Dark Lord, H.P. Lovecraft, Kenneth Grant, and the Typhonian Tradition in Magic. It's our honor to welcome back Peter Lavenda to the program. Peter, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Is Typhonian the correct pronunciation of that word?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Having grown up with a school teacher for a mother, I tend to try to pay attention to things like that. This book, The Dark Lord, makes some really interesting connections and also goes into some depth and detail of the ritual of the magical type practiced by Crowley and Grant and the sources from which they draw these experiences. It's rather eye-opening to a novice to this type of material, such as myself. Many of our listeners who would consider themselves Bible-believing Christians probably not exposed to this type of material either. So it's educational reading and very informative, I think, and just a word of commendation. You do an admirable job of taking very arcane and complex source material and distilling it down to where somebody like me who's reading this type of material for the first time can make some sense of it.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm glad that I'm doing the job, that it gets through that way, because with this kind of material, you're never really sure if you're really explaining it adequately or not.
No. It's frankly a look into a different world. Again, coming at this as from a Christian perspective, this is not a the type of experience to which I have been exposed previously. That is the magical worldview, if I can call it that. And it's educational in that it's my sense, and I'd like your thoughts on this, that it's looking at the supernatural realm from a different perspective, taking information and analyzing it a different way. And my sense is that it's educational to better understand how others are viewing the same material. I mean, does that make sense? And would you agree with that sort of assessment?
Oh, I certainly would. I mean, I think what we fail to realize is that we all live in a spiritual world. The world is a spiritual place. And so much of our culture is ignored by the church, let's say, in general, by, you know, using the term to encompass Christianity in general, and other religious denominations as well, things like science fiction or gothic horror and all of that. These are eruptions of spiritual feelings of some sort or spiritual experiences, and they're channeled into fiction or they're channeled into film, but that doesn't mean that they are any less real for all of that. So what I think is the struggle that we have in trying to understand this material is to realize that, I mean, Lovecraft was an author of fiction. He obviously was an author of fiction. He was even an atheist. He was a self-professed atheist. He believed that he was a scientist. He wanted to be an astronomer when he was a child. So with all of this scientific and atheistic tendencies in Lovecraft and his nature being that way, he winds up becoming an iconic figure in terms of gothic horror and writing about ancient aliens and all this kind of stuff that we see on the Discovery Channel and the History Channel today, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that what is fascinating to me about all of this is that the magical worldview, as you put it, does not draw a line around spirituality and say there's things outside that are not spiritual, whether it's bad spiritual, good spiritual, just I'm using the term in a generic sort of sense. the magical worldview encompasses everything and says that a poem can be, you know, spiritual. A short story of Gothic horror can be spiritual. You know, perhaps nuclear weapons can be spiritual. I mean, the magical worldview incorporates everything, all experience, and tries to assign it certain place in the grand scheme of things. So it's a very interlocking, articulated kind of worldview. And the true magical worldview, I think, from what I can understand from studying it for so many years, is virtually amoral. It doesn't assign moral values to any of these experiences. They're just treated as you might treat a scientific phenomenon, as you might treat a laboratory experiment. So where a believing Christian may cringe at the notion of some kind of communication with an evil spirit, in the magical worldview, this is just one experience among many that has to be gone through, experienced, and categorized.
It's interesting because one of the major complaints about religion, Christianity in particular, from skeptics, the new atheists in particular, is that religion is the source of most of history's wars, and that science is good, and science should be the determinant factor of how we should live our lives. And here in Kenneth Grant, you have what appears to be, and Crowley before him, almost a scientific approach to dealing with the spirit realm, which I think would make most atheists cringe. and certainly that idea was apparently that idea was abhorrent to Lovecraft.
Yes, it was abhorrent to Lovecraft. I mean, Lovecraft had a lot to deal with. I think he suppressed or repressed a lot of emotion and a lot of insight as well, channeling it into his stories. But I think he was a very unhappy person because he could not rectify or somehow manage to balance these two conflicting emotions within him. You're absolutely correct. Aleister Crowley's approach and Kenneth Grant's approach was scientific. Their slogan, the slogan of the journal that Crowley edited called The Equinox, was "Our method is science, our aim is religion." So it was the idea to take a scientific approach to spiritual experience and spiritual phenomenon and try to categorize it and try to analyze it and try to understand where each individual person may be on their spiritual path. In order to do this, they had to synthesize all sorts of religious experience from all over the world. So what Crowley and before him the Golden Dawn was trying to do was create tables where Egyptian gods and Hindu gods and the apostles from the Bible were all somehow related to each other on this grand table in which they tried to show that there were similar characteristics or similar values associated with each of these to try to distill the spiritual experience into a handful of symbols that could be juggled. And then if you juggled them the right way, if you wrote the right formula, you got a predictable result in terms of a spiritual experience. This was really, it really was a kind of a scientific approach to religion and to spirituality. Successful or not is up to, I guess, other people to determine, but this was definitely part of what the plan was. It was not a sort of blind faith approach to spirituality. It was a very conscious, self-conscious, you might say, approach to spirituality. So that does set them apart, kind of.
And so the experiences that and the methods that Crowley and then Grant and then Grant's members of Grant's order followed, which break taboo, especially where Judeo-Christian morality is concerned, because a central part of the means by which they attempted to break through to the other side and see what was beyond the veil, as it were, involved sexual magic. Those experiences were not necessarily, as you say, not necessarily good or bad, or they were simply amoral. They were what, tools in a toolbox, as one attempted to fit the pieces together to build a reliable mechanism for accessing the other side.
Yes, I think that you're describing it accurately. The premise of magicians, especially the last 100 to 200 years or so, was that we should not take anything for granted, that our religious leaders may deceive us, they may lie to us, or they may simply not know enough to satisfy us. When we go to a religious leader for advice on something, we may get a platitude in response. To some people, this is fine. This is enough. The Bible is enough. And a pastor is enough. A minister is enough. But to others, it wasn't. They're more cynical. They perhaps want to see behind the veil. They're paranoid, maybe, or they suspect that there is knowledge that even the priests themselves don't have. So this is what gives rise to this sort of magical impulse. It's like Faust in Goethe's famous novels, famous poem plays, the idea that there is a person of science, a person who is rational, who still recognizes the value of spirituality, but can't rectify it with a scientific worldview, so applies the scientific method to spirituality and says, okay, if I burn this incense on this day to this particular spirit or angel or whatever, what will happen, and make a record of it, write it down. You know, the magical diary is very important. Aleister Crowley filled hundreds and thousands of pages of jottings on everything that he did day by day, considering every act was a magical act. So certainly everything was part of the toolbox, and sexuality was a very important part of this. It goes back to India, probably. It goes back to Tantra. It goes back to a sort of transgressive religious experience in India that, you know, we know as the Tantras. There were sects that met, as we know, in cemeteries to perform sexual rituals, basically surrounded by corpses, because in India the corpses are not buried in the ground. They are left open, or they're cremated, or there's all sorts of means of disposal. But these are very horrific, horrifying places. And the idea was to create a kind of mental shock, this idea of collapsing time, where the act that is supposed to conceive, to lead to conception, to create a human being, would be conducted in a place where humans had died or where bodies were taken. This idea, we're going to break through every boundary, we're going to transgress every taboo, because the taboos are protecting some secret knowledge that we must gain access to. So this was part of what was happening in India for hundreds and hundreds of years. Some of this sort of bled out into the Middle East and eventually into Europe, where it was taken up, and certain types of tantric ideas were brought into the Western occult societies. So this was always part of the program. Sexuality was part of it. Not sexuality in the sense that we may understand it. It was, again, a very mechanistic, cold-blooded sort of approach to the matter. The idea was to use the sexual impulses to push through, as you say, to the other side. A bit like using a hallucinogenic drug, perhaps, or something like that, except with a bit more control.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, given that Lovecraft was writing during an era where stories involving overt sexual content wouldn't be published, clearly wrote about other things that Kenneth Grant saw a connection to what Crowley had developed in the foundation of Telema. What was it in Lovecraft's writing that Grant recognized, and what points of correlation do you see between the writing of H.P. Lovecraft and Telema?
Well, for one thing, as I mentioned in The Dark Lord, the number of coincidences that surrounded Lovecraft and Crowley were considerable, and they led me to believe that some strange phenomenon was taking place, because Lovecraft, his most famous story perhaps, is The Call of Cthulhu, mm-hmm. and in that particular story, there are three sections in the story, and in one of the second section, we have a sort of orgiastic ritual taking place in the swamps outside of New Orleans in Louisiana, and Lovecraft is one of those writers. I mean, he's a very strange guy because he's very specific about dates, something you won't find in, I think, a lot of horror writers, or any writers for that matter, who are writing in this kind of genre. He always will say the month, day, and year. He's very specific about when something transpired, when something occurred. And in The Call of Cthulhu, he's very specific about, you know, the day, month, and year in which this elaborate ceremony was taking place, that he describes in his usual language of eldritch this, you know, and, you know, all the cyclopean that. I mean, he has this terminology, this mm-hmm. very ornate, you know, vocabulary that he uses. And then we find the same vocabulary, the same imagery, in so many cases, was actually written by Aleister Crowley on the same day, month, and year that Lovecraft had posited this ritual taking place. Now, Lovecraft was writing years later. He put the story back a few years, 1907, I believe, in this case, and he was writing fictitiously about this ritual that took place on this particular day. It was Halloween in 1907, and there was this ritual taking place. And he describes the ritual. He describes the surrounding artifacts and everything else, not knowing, because Crowley was virtually unknown at the time, not knowing that Crowley in 1907, on that very day, was writing what he called the Holy Books, a series of different kinds of small chapters and small books, small texts, in which the same imagery is being used, quite deliberately the same imagery. Cyclopean this and, you know, strange standing stones and strange statues and a secret book, which is, of course, the hallmark, the centerpiece of the Call of Cthulhu. All of this, Crowley and Lovecraft were both writing about the same thing, taking place on the same day. And this, to me, even Grant did not recognize, didn't see it. He didn't go through and look at the dates. That's something that I did when I realized that Grant was making this connection between Crowley and Lovecraft. And I'm a researcher. I mean, that's what I do. So I look at data, and I try to see what data is relevant and what goes on. And when I saw these dates popping up, I could not believe what I discovered. And I discovered that these two people, unknown to each other, people who had never heard of each other probably, for the most part, were actually writing about something that happened at the same time and using the same language. The terms of horror, terms of something very sinister, very dark, taking place, occurring, a revulsion against what was taking place at that time. And I think that when Grant read Lovecraft, he understood that Lovecraft was, his disgust, his horror, was Lovecraft's personal reaction to something very powerful, something that he could not himself absorb or get on board, as they say, something that he just rejected completely. And I think from Kenneth Grant's point of view, this was Lovecraft's failing psychologically, that if he could just have opened himself up a bit more, been less atheistic, shall we say, he might have been able to understand what this was all about. He might have seen it as a spiritual breakthrough. Instead, it was a kind of spiritual breakdown for Lovecraft. He had a very, as I say, very unhappy life. I think sexuality was not that particularly important to him also, from what we know of his personal life. And yet in another story, in the Dunwich Horror, he writes about a young woman who is impregnated basically by an extraterrestrial being during a ritual of magic, you know, in a small New England town. So once again, you know, we're in Crowley's territory, basically. So I think Kenneth Grant understood this, and he tried to use Lovecraft's very pronounced symbolism, very pronounced iconography, as a means into this particular realm, into this behind the veil, as you say. He wanted to use these terms, these ideas, these concepts, as if they were actual spiritual beings, actual spiritual references. And that's what puts Kenneth Grant apart.
At this point, we probably ought to, I think we can assume most people have at least heard of H.P. Lovecraft, are familiar with who he is, and at least have a passing familiarity with Aleister Crowley. Kenneth Grant was relatively new to me. I'd heard his name, didn't really know anything about him. For listeners who are not familiar with Kenneth Grant, who was he and what was his contribution to the belief system developed by Crowley?
Well, he actually worked for Crowley for a short time before Crowley's death. He knew him personally, had been initiated into Crowley's occult orders, particularly the OTO, or the Ordo Templi Orientis, the Order of the Temple of the East. This was a secret society that Crowley had kind of inherited from its German founders back around, he joined in the early 1920s, and it had already been in existence for a few years before that, around the turn of the century. The OTO was a typical sort of secret society, for the most part, an occult order. They were interested in magic. They were interested in ritual magic. But they also carried with them a kind of knowledge about sexuality as part of magical ritual as well, which was a very new thing at the time. So Crowley became involved with them. Upon the death of their last leader, Crowley, sort of assumed the mantle and began running the order until his death. Kenneth Grant then was a member of this order, and as I say, he worked with Crowley for a couple of years before Crowley died. After Crowley died, Grant took it upon himself to consider himself the head of the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis. And there was a bit of friction because there were other groups around the world that claimed to be the legitimate successors to Crowley. And then eventually Grant just felt it just wasn't worth the candle. He spent most of his time writing the books that I discuss in The Dark Lord, something called the Typhonian Trilogies. 9 volumes of books that are almost incomprehensible. if you don't have the background, if you haven't gone through this stuff, Grant is the last person you want to start with. He does not explain things very well, except in a few places where it comes through very clear. But then the rest of it, the rest of the time, it's lost in sort of Kabbalistic mumbo jumbo, you might say, and all sorts of references to Indian religion, Islamic traditions, and everything else, to the point where you just throw up your hands and say, "I don't have a clue what's going on here." That was Kenneth Grant's basic contribution, because for a long time nobody was writing about Crowley and Crowley's occult systems with any degree of consistency. They were all just basically recycling old Crowley material. Grant was the only one actually doing anything new, creating new rituals and writing new books and making new discoveries, and that's why Grant became important.
And in his writings, and you bring this out in The Dark Lord, he believed that, as you mentioned, short fiction, poetry, works of art could all be used as part of the ritual, and apparently believed that those creative types who produce those types of work are sensitive to impulses, to thoughts, ideas coming from the other side. And so clearly saw something in Lovecraft that, you know, his sensitivity to what was coming through is what helped to fuel the stories that Lovecraft produced during his career. What conclusion then did Grant reach about the source of this material, or about, you know, the other sources from which he drew, the Indian Hindu religions that he drew from India? I mean, were we hearing from different entities? Was it all the same source? What did Grant think about that?
Well, it's interesting. To an earlier point you just made about people in the arts being sensitive to this sort of thing, Lovecraft himself explicitly states that in Call to Cthulhu. That's when, in the very first section, it's the artists and the sensitives who are suddenly getting the transmissions from Cthulhu, getting the transmissions from the other side, becoming aware that something important is about to happen, some spiritual eruption is about to take place. So Lovecraft specifically said that, and then Grant picked that up in trying to use a system of controlled dreaming and to use dreams as a gateway into the unconscious. And then, as to go back then to your other question, Grant felt that all of these experiences, these images, these visions came from a place on the other side of the tree of life in the Kabbalah, which is a sort of diagram, which is a mandala, you might say. It's an all-encompassing cosmological diagram. Anything in existence, anything that's been experienced in the world should find a place on this diagram. It's that comprehensive. And to Grant, there was another side to this tree. There was the dark side of the tree of life. We may take the tree of life symbolism and go back to the Bible, go back to Genesis, and try to understand what he means by all of this. But he believed that there was a serpent in the garden, and the serpent brought wisdom. The kind of wisdom that is extremely dangerous, but is nonetheless true for all of that. And so to Grant, he felt that these dreams, these images, the gods of ancient India, for instance, and of the Mayans and the Aztecs in Latin America and from all over the place were all coming from this dark side. There were messages being transmitted. And remember, this was long before Zachariah Sitchin, long before Eric von Daniken, long before the ancient aliens hypothesis. This was something that Lovecraft basically touched first, probably among most writers. He was one of the first to start writing about the fact that maybe civilization had been seeded from alien beings. Maybe we had been visited by completely different alien forces. You may refer to them as Nephilim, mm-hmm. or something like that. And that this contact was so important that we're still trying to understand it. We're still trying to process it. And that's what Lovecraft was doing. And that's what Grant was doing as well. And that's what Crowley was doing. Crowley was receiving transmissions from the other side constantly, not always able to understand what was being communicated. So there's this idea that there is this force, this dark force on the other side of the Tree of Life that is trying to communicate with the rest of us, and that those of us who are the most sensitive, the most artistic perhaps, or even the most spiritual, will be the first ones to get these transmissions, or the first ones to feel the effects of this.
Hmm. You write in The Dark Lord that, and I quote, "It is at the heart of the current fascination with ancient aliens and alien archaeology and all those Discovery Channel and History Channel specials about the theories of von Däniken and Zechariah Sitchin, for example. It is central to fears about the coming of the Antichrist, the prophecies of Nostradamus, and the Chiliastic panic about the..." Chiliastic, is that the correct pronunciation there? Or?
I think it's Chiliastic, but okay, Chiliastic. I'll go with Chile.
Okay. Well, south of the border, it could be either. Chiliastic panic about the Mayan calendar and the end of the year 2012. Is this then a this sort of theme, this ancient aliens meme that has been propagated and seems to be becoming more and more mainstream in recent years, sort of this same message from the other side, sort of bleeding around the edges of our culture and seeping into the mainstream consciousness?
Oh, I think so. I think that this is gaining more and more strength. It's kind of an end times kind of feeling. It's this idea that, you know, some people will say, oh, we're on the verge of contact with our brothers in the UFOs. You know, there's that one crowd that's going to say that. Mm-hmm. There's another crowd that's going to talk about, you know, the end times and the Antichrist. There's another crowd that's going to talk about something else. But they're all agreeing that something is taking place, that something is happening, that there's a kind of rent in cosmic consciousness. As one author said some time ago, there was a hole was being ripped through, you know, the fabric between this world and the next, and there were forces that were massing on the other side of this, trying to get through the gate. According to one, you know, set of beliefs, this happened in 1947. Mm-hmm. We had the death of Crowley in that year. We had the famous UFO Roswell stuff taking place in 47, and we had ritual magic that was being conducted by Jack Parsons and Ron Hubbard and all that good stuff taking place mm-hmm. in the deserts outside of Pasadena with a specific goal of opening that gate and getting something to come through. So all of this was taking place then, and of course the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls took place the same year.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot was going on then, and there's this idea that that started it, that there was the beginning was there somehow, and that gradually, stronger and more stronger every year, these forces, whatever they are making themselves known. And if you have that kind of sensitivity, it's almost impossible to turn on a television set and not be hit with it almost everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
If you step back just a little bit and watch what you're watching, virtually every program you're going to see is talking to you about this.
Yeah, yeah. And again, different faith traditions will be exploring what apparently a different part of the elephant.
Yes.
And trying to describe it. Specific to 1947, and I want to touch, you get a little more into Kenneth Grant and the Typhonian tradition and what that represents relative to and how it differs from the Crowleyan tradition, the Aeon of Horus, rather. But specific to 1947, this is something that's been talked about on this program more than a couple of times. You know, the ritual, the Babylon working performed by Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard.
Sure.
The comment was made by Bible scholar Dr. Mike Heiser that if in fact these entities were waiting on a couple of guys in the desert outside Pasadena to have sex on the right days and in the right ways to come through, then these, and I'm paraphrasing of course, but the sense of what he was saying is that if this in fact is the way things really happened, and that this was contingent upon these two guys doing these works, then these are some pretty lame ass entities. you know, and when I stepped back and thought about that for a moment, I thought, okay, well, that actually makes some kind of sense. If these entities are really as powerful and as dangerous as they are supposed to be, and we you know, it's easy to draw that conclusion looking at the way the world around us is almost literally going to hell in a handbasket. Why is it that they depend on us frail, fragile, flawed humans to do these certain things in the right order to give them permission to come in?
Well, it's a bit like the old saw about vampires, that they can't cross your threshold unless you invite them.
Right.
I mean, a vampire can be all powerful, can fly through the air, change their form at will, live forever, be virtually immortal, but they can't actually go into your house, you know, unless you actually invite
them. Right. And there's a parallel in Christian belief that, those who are indwelt with the Holy Spirit, because he that is in you is greater than he that is in the world, referring to the prince of this world or the God of this world, that while you can be perhaps oppressed by demons, you're not going to be possessed by demons.
Right.
So the question then is, Parsons got more than he bargained for, because he was killed in an explosion in his laboratories just about 4 years later, or just a couple of years later. But how could that working grant permission to whatever came through to begin affecting all the rest of us?
Well, in the first place, it was number one intention. I think that Parsons and Hubbard in their rituals were deliberately intending to do just exactly what they were doing. It's different if you mistakenly do something, or if you think you're doing, you know, the right thing and then something bad happens. These guys are out there deliberately doing it. Yeah, it was lame ass. I don't have any problem with that designation.
But, and again, I don't know that that's not what Mike said, but that was essentially
like
his meaning. Yeah.
I like it. I think it's perfect. So lay mass, yes, is fine. And there's all sorts of Kabbalistic reasons why lay mass would be a good designation. And we won't get into that in this program.
Okay.
But anyway, but from my point of view, it's more than a linear cause and effect situation. I think that when we think in terms of Newtonian physics and we think in terms of cause and effect, and you know, there has to be every effect has a cause, we're missing the point here. There's something, as I try to imply in Sinister Forces and in other books, sometimes cause and effect does not explain the phenomena that we witness. Mm-hmm. I give as my famous example, you know, the Kennedy assassination, and here's a Belgian mystic, you know, years before Kennedy is born, writing plays about the assassination.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Texas school book, the Texas Tower in Austin, Texas, the guy who went crazy, the sniper, and started shooting people. Almost exactly, it was prefigured in a novel written a few years before. That doesn't mean the guy who wrote the novel caused this thing to happen.
Right, right.
It doesn't mean the Belgian mystic caused the Kennedy assassination.
But more recently, in the pilot of the short-lived television series The Lone Gunman, where a passenger jet was intended to be flown right into the Twin Towers. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
and it's something that the Columbine shooters were also fantasizing about. In their writings that were released after the famous Columbine shootings, they were also fantasizing about flying planes into the World Trade Center.
Hmm.
And I'm researching a book right now in which a famous Nazi ideologue in the United States, an American back in the 1930s, was again saying the same thing, saying, why, you know, shouldn't somebody fly a plane into one of those tall buildings and kill a lot of Jews? So in the 1930s, you know, prefiguring all of this, they didn't cause that to happen. And perhaps Parsons and Hubbard did not cause the things that took place, you know, to occur. I don't think anyone was waiting for that. I think what happened was they basically invited the vampire across the threshold. The vampire was going to come anyway. The forces were there. All of this was going to take place. They were looking for an easy way in, and Parsons and Hubbard proved to be the weak link in you know, human society and civilization, if you want to look at it that way, because they were actually opening the door, doing everything correctly that would allow the forces to, you know, that were massing on the other side to come through the gate. This is a possible way of looking at it. It's not necessarily cause and effect the way we think it. It could be that Parsons and Hubbard were in that place at that time for that reason, that the effect preceded the cause. But that's Indian philosophy, and that's, you know, that's a whole other way of looking at the world.
Just like the Apostle Judas was always going to be the one who betrayed Jesus Christ. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
The Typhonian tradition, the Typhon is the Greek word that, or the Greek name for the Egyptian god Set. Yes. How did Grant identify Set, who is the enemy of Horus, who was the Egyptian god for which Crowley named his new aeon? How was it that Crowley determined that it was Set who was sort of the key to all of this and the key to why fixate on Set? What is the purpose? What role does he play relative to Horus in the magical system that Grant developed?
Well, it's interesting because, as you mentioned about Judas, Judas was always going to be the one who betrayed Jesus. And in another sense, being brought up a Catholic, I was always told that there would not have been a Christmas had there not been a Good Friday and an Easter Sunday. Huh. Christmas wouldn't have happened. This again, the effect preceding the cause. And in this case, Set was important to the entire story, because without Set, there would have been no murder of Osiris and no birth of Horus, the avenging sun. In a sense, Set was the person who put all of this in motion. Set is the most mysterious of all the Egyptian deities because Set is the oldest. He's so old, in fact, that his totem animal is unknown. It's unrecognized. No one knows what it is. Huh. It's an animal that possibly is extinct. So he's ancient. He's old. He represents, I think, raw power, power that's been untamed, unrestrained. He represents the other. He represents transgression. And all of these were things that appealed to Crowley very, very deeply. Anything transgressive was fine with him. Mm-hmm. Horus was the poster boy for the New Age because it's a crowned and conquering child in this terminology. And what could be sweeter than a crowned and conquering child? But in the back of it, Crowley saw Set as essentially Horus's twin brother. And in some Egyptian texts, Horus and Set are brothers. Egyptian mythology is not consistent from dynasty to dynasty. Mm-hmm. So you will find that they undergo all sorts of changes along the way. And in some of the texts, Horus and Set are brothers. They're siblings who fight with each other. There is even a very strange story of the attempted rape of Horus by Set. Horus manages to thwart that in his own inimitable way. but there's all sorts of, you know, strange dynamics between the two. And I think Crowley understood that. Crowley struggled with it. He didn't really come out and glorify Set very much, but then he left that to Grant. Grant then came out and said, listen, this is really more about Set than it is about Horus, or it's about both of them equally. We have to reinterpret who Horus really is. This crowned and conquering child is not the sweet little bundle of joy that we think he is. He perhaps represents a major shift in, let's say, cosmic consciousness, a major shift in our social and cultural paradigms that everyone is predicting is about to take place, some sort of singularity or a grand concurrence that's going to take place, which will bring all of these things that we're talking about into the quote-unquote real world.
There are some differences between the astronomical influences on the magical system of Grant and that of Crowley. You describe the Typhonian tradition of Grant as astral in origin or nature, and Crowley's as solar. What's the difference, and why is it important?
Well, that's a very heavy question. It's it really is a shift in perspective. I think that from Crowley's point of view, Crowley had very little truck with astrology. He really didn't think it was all that useful. So he kind of denigrated it a bit, but Crowley's system, you know, sort of relied upon traditional ideas about the planets and the sun and the moon and their effects on the human organism and all of that. So he was sort of traditionalist in that way, although he didn't spend too much attention. But to Crowley, Crowley was solar-oriented. He thought that Horus was a solar force. Osiris was a solar force. To Crowley, everything was a solar force. He saw the sun as being the most important of the luminaries and something that was, you know, all-powerful. And the ancients worshipped the sun and so forth. Grant was a bit more sophisticated that way. And I think that Grant understood that the real forces were not in our solar system. They were far beyond the solar system. He understood the fixed stars as being more important, and the circumpolar stars the ones that revolve around the North Star as being the most important. And I had written about this in a book I wrote some years ago called Stairway to Heaven. I went through in a very sort of academic way, and I went through trying to prove that these seven stars of the Big Dipper were actually those most important, that the planets, the so-called seven planets, was a blind, was a way of distracting people from the real steps to immortality. The ancients really focused more on those seven stars. They were the ones that were more important because they led right to the North Star, which never set below the horizon, mm-hmm. which was always there in the same place all the time. What better representative of immortality and the throne of God? I think Ezekiel, in the book of Ezekiel, in the first few chapters, he's really writing about that constellation. I went back and did an astronomical chart based on, he's very specific too, Ezekiel, like Lovecraft. Mm-hmm. Ezekiel actually gives you the day, month, and time when all of this was going on, so it's easy to go back and to get a map of the heavens at that day, month, and time. And, you know, he's facing the Big Dipper. He's facing the North. He's facing the North Star. He's facing the Big Dipper. And the recurrence of the number seven in so many religions and so many cultures around the world, I think, points to those seven stars. Does not point to the seven planets. The ancients were not that stupid. They didn't believe the sun and moon were the same thing as the other five planets. They realized there was a big difference. They were not sort of ignorant savages who looked up in the heavens and counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Mm-hmm. I don't believe it worked that way at all. And I think that the seven, that number refers to those seven stars that are visible circulating around the circumpolar, the pole star. So I think Grant understood this, and, you know, to Grant, the stars are far more important because those stars, those specific stars, are represented in Egyptian religion as the thigh of Set. This is a very strange kind of icon that the Egyptians use in the mummification ritual in opening the mouth of the mummy and giving the mummy life during the ritual. The mummy has been embalmed, it's been wrapped, all these things have happened to it, and now the mummy is brought upright, and a figure, a priest representing Set, is holding a very specifically shaped object in his hand, made out of meteoric iron, quite possibly magnetized iron, which would point north. Mm-hmm. And he's using that device to open the mouth of the mummy so the mummy can talk and breathe. So again, Grant understood that this was a key issue. Nothing to do with the solar stuff that Crowley was writing about. It was astral, and it depended on the stars. And with the stars, we're back with Lovecraft, and we're back with his obsessions.
Mm-hmm. And we're also back to at least one link with the Bible, because the stars is often referred to as used as a euphemism for the divine council, if you will, the sons of God, or the angel, the angels that make up the heavenly host. Interesting.
Exactly.
You mentioned that Set is an interesting character. The whole idea of a deity representing chaos, because that goes all the way back to ancient Sumer. What characteristics did Grant see in Set?
Well, I think what Grant understood about Set was that Set represented chaos, as you said. Of course, that was one of his major attributes. But perhaps we might say unbridled sexuality. Grant, of course, like Crowley to a certain extent, saw things in sexual terms. And I think from his point of view, Set represented unbridled sexuality, sexuality that was not controlled. Set was raw power, and it was up to the state, to religion, to society, to control the power, not to throw Set overboard, not to try to extinguish Set altogether, but to tame Set, to make Set part of the pantheon of the gods, because Set did have a function. In some of the pyramid texts and in the so-called Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Book of Coming Forth by Day, you'll see a boat going through the underworld. And there's Set at the prow of the boat, killing the evil serpents that are trying to attack the boat. Set is force, power, violence even. But to the Egyptians, this was a kind of violence that could be put to the service of the state. Again, there was no moralizing about violence. There was no moralizing about sexuality, for that matter. It all depended on how it was used, and I guess who was using it. And in terms of Set, as I said before, Set, one of Set's famous scenes in the contendings of Horus and Set, it's an old Egyptian document, is Set trying to sodomize Horus. I mean, Set is sort of, he doesn't care. I mean, Set is pure, raw force, violence, sexuality, all of these things mixed together. And I think that Grant understood that if we don't come to terms with this kind of material in a constructive way, we may have to deal with it as victims. If, you know, we have to understand what it is. We have to understand it within ourselves, within society. We have to find a way to understand what violence is. How is it connected to sexuality? We always hear that rape is not a crime of sex. It's a crime of violence. And that's true in as far as it goes. But then why is it rape and not, you know, shooting somebody with a gun? Mm-hmm. Or strangling someone? Why is sex used as a weapon? So I think Set represents that. Set is at the core of this. He may be at the core of what it means to be human. We're humans who are a kind of battleground between, you know, the flesh and the spirit. And Set represents, I think, more than anything else, the flesh. But he's ironically a spiritual analog of what the flesh is. And I think that's what obsessed Grant, I think, where Set was concerned.
Grant was, in effect, trying to do on a supernatural level what the fictional character Dr. Jekyll was trying to do in identifying and controlling Mr. Hyde.
Right, and you could say that Set basically is Mr. Hyde, for sure.
Hmm. This may be a bit of a rabbit trail, but I found this interesting because I've got a friend who's living in the area now and teaching English over there. There was some fascination on the part of occult researchers with the Yazidi people of the Middle East. What was it about their belief system that attracted their attention, and is it related in any way to this link between the Crowleyan and Grant traditions of Telema?
Well, it's a fascinating subject, and I would love to hear more about your friend who's over there doing teaching. The Yazidi are a fascinating ethnic group. I've been writing about them in other places, but of course the Dark Lord, I write about them a bit in there because the Yazidi are mentioned in passing by Crowley and by Grant, and they don't really focus on them at all. And I did a lot of homework on them. The Yazidi were considered to be devil worshippers by the first European travelers and archaeologists and anthropologists who started to go through that area at the end of the middle, let's say, of the 19th century up until the middle of the 20th century. There was this idea that they were actually literally worshiping the devil. And there's a reason for that. I mean, the Yazidi may tell you, no, we don't actually worship the devil, but it's kind of hard, you know, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck. in the case of the Yazidi, they're Shaitan or Satan is a holy name. It's so holy that they avoid speaking words that have that initial letter SH in them. That sh sound is avoided because you may inadvertently call Shaitan.
Hmm.
And what's interesting is that Shaitan has the same vocal root as the word for Set. In fact, in ancient Egypt, we're not quite sure how they pronounce Set, and some scholars believe it was pronounced Shet.
Hmm.
So if it was Shet and Shaitan, and actually, the Yazidi claim their origins go back to ancient Sumer. So we start to have these weird sort of traditions going back for thousands of years. We're not sure if the Yazidi are accurate in saying their origins go back to Sumer. Ethnically, we think that they're of a piece with the groups and with the Kurdish tribes in the same area. But their religion is so bizarre and so unique and so otherworldly that everybody hates them out there. I mean, yeah. Even the other Kurds, I mean, who are been victimized by everyone in the region, mm-hmm. Even the Kurds will victimize the Yazidi because they think the Yazidi are just way beyond the pale. The Yazidi are not Christian. They're not Muslim. They're not Jewish, but they partake of elements of all of these. They bury their dead facing the north, facing the North Star specifically.
Hmm.
So there's another analog for us to look at. They worship in caves. They have, of course, their own shrines also, but they have sacred caves, and they inscribe serpents on the entrances to these caves. They have rituals that no one else has. They have a holiday system that no one else has. They're a unique people. There's no question about it. I'm fascinated by them. I'm fascinated by their the stories that they tell, and the fact that we can't get a copy of their sacred books. There's another issue here, and that is the so-called Black Book of the Yazidi, which is supposed to contain the story of the creation from a whole different perspective. In this story, God has created humans, and he has ordered the angels to bow down and worship them. Well, one angel, Shaitan, refuses to do so, but he does so for a good reason. He does so because God had told him that he should bow the knee before no one except God. So Shaitan is disobeying God because he's obeying God's earlier commandment. For that reason, God then banishes Shaitan out of heaven with the promise that he will be the first among the angels to come back into heaven once paradise has been restored. Hence, the Yazidi worship Shaitan as their leader, as the person, because they want to be right in line behind Shaitan when he goes back into heaven. So there's that story. Now, there have been translations, so-called, of the Yazidi holy books, but they're very controversial because people think they were hoaxes. They think that even though there are elements in these translations that are consistent with Yazidi belief, as much as we know them, we cannot be sure the texts are actually genuine. No one knows if the books even still exist. Some Yazidi priests will say, no, they were destroyed in one or another of the Crusades or the pogroms or whatever happened in the Middle East. So you're not getting a straight story really from anyone where this is concerned. You cannot, you're not allowed to become a Yazidi. You cannot just join the clan. So it's, you know, they're dying out, basically. They're getting smaller and smaller. And a lot of Yazidi actually have come to the United States. They're living out in the Midwest. After the Iraqi situation, the first Iraqi invasion, the first Gulf War, a lot of Yazidi took that opportunity to escape, and more have been escaping since then because they're victimized by everyone. So now there's a lot of a large Yazidi population here in the U.S., and they're trying to discuss who they are in a calm, rational way. But when you look at their logo, it's a peacock, which is considered bad luck by so many different cultures around the world. So there's a peacock, and then there's Sumerian writing along the side in cuneiform, you know, and all sorts of other symbols that when you look at it, you think, wow, you know, maybe they were right. Maybe they are devil worshippers. You know? So it's a, they are a very strange, unique group, and I find them fascinating. But Crowley and Grant spend very little time on them, and that's possibly because there hasn't been a lot of research done with the Yazidi until comparatively recently. There was an American explorer who had gone through the Middle East and claimed that the Yazidi were worshiping the devil, that they had seven or nine towers, the towers of silence, he called them, sort of similar to the towers of silence in India, where priests would then invoke Satan from the top of these towers in a kind of network of towers stretching across the Middle East all the way out into Tibet and into Mongolia. This was a story he, I think, made up. There's no real factual evidence towards this, but this guy was a friend of Crowley, and Crowley would have gotten some information from him. So there's William Seabrook is his name. He was a very famous explorer for a while. He wrote a lot of interesting stories about, you know, strange cultures and stuff, and he did travel in those regions. He wrote a book about Haitian voodoo that was very popular for a while, although a bit misguided, but still he popularized this kind of material, and he and Crowley were friendly, so we don't know where the Yazidi stuff came from, but, you know, if you're a Leicester Crowley and someone tells you there's an ancient devil-worshipping cult in Iraq, you know, sold, where do I sign up? Basically what happened with that, with the Yazidi stories, I think.
And I should mention, my friend actually is in Turkey rather than on the Iraqi side. There are some Yazidi communities apparently in Turkey, but as you say,
right across the border, yes. With the Kurdish migrations out of Iraq, sure, they took advantage and wound up in Turkey for sure.
A lot of points of correlation here. You mentioned the number seven, and it's recurrence in a variety of religious traditions, the North, and that reminds me that over and over again, and you see in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, that the enemy of Israel is usually portrayed as coming from the North.
Yes,
there is also in Daniel chapter 11, some of the prophetic verses toward the end of that chapter that talk about a an attack against the Antichrist that'll come from the North, and that coalition is defeated by the Antichrist. There is also Well, again, in number seven, so many different points of correlation, but referring specifically to Set and the ancient chaos entity, which was what in Sumerian tradition, Tiamat, T-I-A-M-A-T, yeah. In the Old Testament is referred to as Leviathan, know, the seven-headed chaos dragon. And of course, then you fast forward to the Book of Revelation, and you've got this beast with seven heads and 10 horns that plays a significant role during the period of the end times. So there, again, a lot of points of correlation, and you know, coming back to your study of Grant and his analysis of the correlations between Lovecraft and other works of art and creativity. Why are we seeing so many similarities? Are we just borrowing from each other because nobody's creative anymore? Or again, is inspiration coming from what Grant referred to as the mauve zone?
I would go with the latter only because from my own experience and doing this kind of research and in over the years, I have found these coincidences begin multiplying really readily. As soon as you start getting very involved in this subject matter, you start seeing it come through. I for a while I thought this was some sort of weird psychological, phenomenon that I'm overthinking or I'm overreacting to. But then I look at this bizarre coincidence between Lovecraft and Crowley in 1907 and all of that going on. And you have to read The Dark Lord to see why I really believe they were talking about the same thing. Something was taking place. There is something that's going on. I think when you mentioned Leviathan in the Bible, there's that famous phrase about Leviathan, those who are skillful to rouse Leviathan. Mm-hmm. What does that mean, right? I mean, the assumption is that there are those out there who will summon Leviathan from the deep, from the abyss. This is the Crowley material. This is the Lovecraft material and the Grant material. You know, they're skillful in rousing Leviathan. They'd like to be. And so this recurrence of the sevens, I think, refers to that. I mean, it goes back again to the north, and it goes back to the stars. The ancient Chinese, the Taoist practitioners, believed that they could attain immortality if they walked on those seven stars. And so what they did was they created maps of the seven stars like carpets that they would walk on using certain types of meditation and certain types of prayers, imagining themselves ascending on those seven stars to reach the throne of immortality. Merkava mysticism, the Jewish Chechalot and Merkava mysticism, in which they, again, they go through the various heavens, usually seven, to attain the throne of God, to stand before the throne of God, first standing in front of the throne of Metatron, and then after Metatron or Chanush or Enoch, then they would actually stand in front of God if they were successful in passing all those seven steps. In Sumer, Inanna goes down into the underworld through seven stages, stage after stage, removing an article of clothing until she no longer has basically a physical form. And then she confronts her sister, who's the goddess of death. She's eventually rescued. She goes back up the seven steps into our world, taking up the discarded clothing as she goes, and then enters our world. But as she does so, the demons who are living in the underworld come out with her. So there's this idea, there's a seven-staged process at the end of which something happens, whether it's miraculous good or just something really strange, something that really unsettles you, something that changes your life, whatever you want to call it. But there's that process that takes place, and everyone, including shamans in Siberia, seem to have been aware of it, seem to have been aware of this process. In ancient India and in current-day India, present-day India, Kundalini yoga involves a climb of seven centers in the body to reach the seventh, the crown at the top of the head. This is a recurring thing, and the funny thing is, seven is an awkward number. It doesn't evenly divide into anything. You know, if you take the circle of 360 degrees, you can divide that circle by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 8, 9, 10, 12, whatever, and get even numbers. But if you try to divide 360 by 7, you get nowhere. Mm-hmm. It's the one number that really is an awkward number. It's a number that is unique because it doesn't seem to fit. And yet we have those seven stars of the Dipper, and, you know, we have this insistent mythology or iconography or ideology, whatever you want to call it, spirituality around this number. The Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice that came out of the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran, they're replete with references to the number seven. So something is going on there. You know, and the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice were about preparing the world for battle, you know, with the forces of evil.
Mm-hmm. And bringing it back to H.P. Lovecraft, you make the interesting connection that the Kundalini spirit that lies sleeping at the base of the spine, Cthulhu is the dead god who is dead but dreaming, waiting for the stars to align properly and return and put out a call for the great old ones to return.
Yes.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff.
I see it as analog. I mean, I see they're all talking about the same thing. Why use icons that are so specific, you know? I mean, the terminology they use is so consistent from one culture to the next. This is what got my attention very early on. I started to see these correlations. And, you know, it's not fashionable in religious studies circles to talk about, you know, universalism, you know. It's not fashionable to talk about these things being linked in any way. You're supposed to look at every ethnic group and every culture as being absolutely distinct.
Right, right. No connection. Possible link or influence from one to another, sure.
Nope, nothing to see here, folks. Move right along.
Yeah.
So I understand that. Of course, we don't want to reduce, we don't want to be reductive and reduce all cultures to a single culture or think of an Ur culture that started everything. I don't think we have to. I think we can still look at the fact that we're all human beings. We all have the same basic physical composition. We all share a common ancestor genetically. So why wouldn't we see spirituality in similar terms? It doesn't mean that, you know, we're not different. That doesn't mean that we should not celebrate our diversity. But at the same time, we're diverse, but we're also the same in some ways. And I think it's the sameness that we're talking about with these esoteric traditions in particular.
Yeah. And of course, in academia, the most of academia anyway, the idea that humanity is being influenced by something from the outside is not going to get much traction.
Right. It's not, you know, and because they're going to say, well, where's your proof? Where's your evidence? And unfortunately, the evidence is, you know, it was in this
dream that this guy had.
Yeah. Right. There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Facts, not an evidence. You know. Mm. But it's still, you know, when you're permeated with it, when your culture is surrounded with it, where you can't look anywhere without seeing it, and then someone asks you for proof, it's, you know, I mean, it's a little tedious, but I understand the scientific point of view because science is limited by materialism. I mean, mm-hmm. they have a materialistic view of reality, and it's purely materialistic, and it's nice and comfortable. If you are comfortable with it, you know, you can say, well, if I can't see it, it doesn't exist. If I'm seeing it and it's, you know, and it's really not there, there's something wrong with me and I better go to a doctor and get a drug, mm-hmm. you know. If an angel talks to me, I must be, you know, sick. I must have a psychological disorder. There was a tendency in the 60s and 70s for a while to say maybe these experiences are spiritually beneficial. Maybe they're actually good. But then that got shot down when they found that there were drugs that could control schizophrenia and things like that. So we went back to the materialistic approach and we dropped the sort of human-centered, let's see if we can work through this approach. Because maybe what you're experiencing and the hallucinations you're having and the voices you're hearing may be trying to tell you something, you know. Maybe we'll work with it a little while and see if we can't, you know, work with it and see if we can't go through it. It was R.D. Lang, the famous Scottish psychiatrist, who said sometimes a nervous breakdown is really a breakthrough. But we lost that, as I say. It became more fashionable to use drugs and pharmacology to treat psychological disorders, which are spiritual disorders, aren't they? I mean,
yeah, you just have to wonder how many of the Old Testament books of the Bible would actually have been written if they'd had those sorts of drugs back in the days of Ezekiel and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Amos and Joel and so on.
Oh my, if they had Prozac in those days, none of that would have gotten written.
Yeah, exactly.
None of it would have been written.
Well, there's an interesting theory out there, and I've actually, I've talked with Dr. Rick Strassman about his book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule, research that was done into the effects of DMT and his theory that those who partake of that drug, the substance.
Ayahuasca.
Yeah, are actually moving into or able to move into the same sort of spirit realm that the Old Testament prophets were brought into.
I have to kind of agree to that. I'm a person who in the past has taken psilocybin.
Okay.
And not frequently. This is not something you want to do. It's not a recreational thing.
From what I've read about that, yeah.
Right up front, this is something maybe once in a lifetime is more than enough. But what it does is it does gives you that insight. You begin to realize, you begin to see what people were seeing, people like the Old Testament prophets. And the DMT research is fascinating. And I think the fact that we're beginning to understand that our pineal gland maybe is a secretor of DMT
right.
would explain yoga, would explain Kundalini yoga in particular. The idea that you're trying to attune the pineal gland to open it up so that it releases more DMT so you have this experience. I think it will explain Tantra. I won't get into that right now. This is probably a family channel.
Yeah.
Family program. But I think we're...
Read the book.
We're Tantras. Yeah, read the book. So I think that I think the DMT factor is there in Tantra as well. I think that it would explain a great deal. So I'm very interested in all the DMT research that's been taking place recently. Graham Hancock has been talking about it. A lot of people are talking about it now.
The thing that disturbed me a little bit in talking with Dr. Strassman was that he reported that the experiences of many of the subjects in the sessions that he oversaw were really disturbed by what they saw. I mean, what they saw were things that were not necessarily friendly. And that would, I think, be consistent with the warning that Yahweh gave to Moses saying, hey, you know, people don't consult with necromancers. Okay. Don't mess with this, you know, because you don't know what you're doing. And yet he advocates more research along those lines.
Well, I look at it this way. I think that you're perfectly correct. People see things that they're not happy with, things that are evil sounding or looking, things that are threatening. But this is a mainstay of practically every initiatory practice you'll ever come across. You confront what appear to be evil creatures before you can get past the gates, before you can enter the temple. They're guardians. And the reason that they're evil, the reason that they are so threatening, is because you are in an impure state yourself. And it's your impurities that are causing this experience. It's like, again, going back to my Catholic upbringing, which I'm sorry to keep bringing that up.
That's all right.
But we had the idea of purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
So you had sins, you were in an impure state, so you went to basically hell. But for a short period of time, you got paroled later, you know, and on good behavior, you were allowed back into heaven. This is the same concept. You face guardians at the gate, the lurker at the threshold, as Lovecraft would have put it. And this is the guardian that keeps you from entering while you're in an impure state. There is a film version of The Magic Flute, Mozart's famous Masonic initiatory opera.
Right, yeah.
And you will see, you know, these evil guardians standing in front of the gate. But as soon as the person has become purified, the guardians turn around. These horrible masks suddenly disappear because you were looking at the back of the guardians. The guardians turn around. They're just like friendly guys, you know, come on in. But you have to get past that. In ancient India or in present-day India, it's Kali, the goddess, who looks so fearful, so fearsome, a hideous creature, who actually is worshipped by the faithful because they understand that her hideous aspect is a reflection of their own inadequacy, their own impurities, and that once they attain a certain level of spiritual enlightenment, that the beams from their eyes will fall away, and they'll actually see the goddess for the way she really appears, as a beautiful goddess, as something radiating peace and light. So can any of us, do any of us dare to look upon the face of God? I mean, God tells Moses, you can't look
right
on my face. You know, you just can't. And when Moses does attempt this, and he does see a little of it, he comes down and his face is burned, as if he had radiation burns.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember that episode. So, and of course you do. So this is, you know, this is something that goes through all of spirituality. There are dangers, and DMT presents some of them. So does psilocybin, I can attest.
Mm-hmm.
So these things do exist. These horrors do exist. And yet when you get through it, I can't say this for everybody. I'm not advocating it for anyone. But it has happened that going through it, then you come out on the other side and you realize that, you know, the world is not what it seems to be. It's actually a much nicer place than you really think it is. You just have to get to that point where you can see past your own inadequacies, your own vulnerabilities, your own impurities. And let's face it, most of us, all of us, are impure to one extent or another.
Yeah.
And it's ridding oneself of those impurities, whether it's a clean living and, you know, being earnest in prayer or whatever approach you have to take. It does lead to a sudden different kind of vision of the world. And you look around yourself and you won't see hell anymore. You'll see something else.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is not part of the book, just something that struck me as we were discussing earlier in the conversation about the scientific approach toward experimenting with the spirit realm. The subject of Dan Brown's novel, The Lost Symbol, was thought to be Freemasonry, but actually was the Institute of Noetics, or the Institute of Noetic Science, co-founded by Paul N. Temple and Edgar Mitchell. And Paul Temple, interestingly, one of the major financiers of a group, purportedly evangelical Christian group, called the Family or the Brotherhood, the group that sponsors the presidential prayer breakfast every year, essentially using scientific method to try to research the spirit realm. What would Kenneth Grant, do you think, or Aleister Crowley have thought of the Institute of Noetic Science?
They might have considered them posers from their point of view. I mean, they would have welcomed the impulse to do just exactly what Crowley had been advocating for decades, to use, you know, a scientific approach to, you know, to religion, to spirituality. I think he would have applauded that, so would Grant. But at the same time, they would be a little skeptical. You know, are the people doing this, are they atheistic scientists? Are they materialists who are trying to, you know, weaponize maybe spirituality in some way? They would have been a little cynical about it, a little nervous, I think, about it. But I think in general, they might have welcomed the impulse as being a noble one, because that's what they really stood for. To look at these guys as if they were a crazed crackpot, pseudo psychics or something would be to miss the point completely. They were bizarre individuals, you know, there's no question about it in many ways, but I think that their intention was to break through once and for all to find out what was really going on in the black box of consciousness. And I think that's what they really wanted to find out. How do we do this? And if we have to use all these weird drugs and sexuality and ritual magic and all the rest of it to get there, well, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take a fearless approach to the unconscious mind. This was like therapy, like depth psychology, like Jungian depth psychology, except it was an active version. You know, Jungian psychology, you sort of lay down on the couch and talk about your dreams. This approach of Crowley and Grant was to actively go into the dream, you know, it was actively to control the dream, was to create the experiences that you'd have something to talk about, something to analyze. It was not a form of therapy, really. It was a form of analysis. But they believed that what they discovered would be applicable in general terms to everyone. So they thought of themselves as pioneers into the unconscious mind. So for that reason, they might have, you know, welcomed the noetic science people. They might have been cynical and skeptical of them, but they would have welcomed, as I say, the impulse.
Interesting stuff. And very educational. The book is The Dark Lord, H.P. Lovecraft, Kenneth Grant, and the Typhonian Tradition in Magic. And I'll have to mention again that as a Father's Day gift a couple of years ago, my daughter sent me a package. Actually, it was sent by the person who actually made this little trinket. It showed up at our door in a padded envelope one day. No return address that I could recognize. The postage stamp was California, and I opened it up and saw this little knit Cthulhu keychain. And I had to wonder, I mean, who was sending this to me out of the blue? Should I be concerned? Should I take this our friend the deliverance minister, perhaps? and then got a phone call later that day from our daughter, who had sent it as a kind of a joke for a Father's Day gift. So it's around here somewhere. Kind of cute, actually, sort of like the little web cartoon a year that of recent years, Hello Cthulhu, based on a parody of Hello Kitty.
Right.
Anyway,
yeah.
But a serious topic, and we appreciate your research and your work and your writing on this, Peter. Like to have you back again as we get closer to April, which of course is the birth month of Adolf Hitler, to talk about your research into the disappearance of Adolf Hitler. Your book Ratline, back in the news again, as Dr. Jerome Corsi has just weighed in with a new book on the subject, What Happened to Hitler at the End of World War II. So if not sooner, certainly like to have you back to talk about that.
Absolutely.
All right, Peter Levenda, the author of The Dark Lord, H.P. Lovecraft, Kenneth Grant, and the Typhonian Tradition and Magic. Peter, thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
You find a link to where you can find The Dark Lord, H.P. Lovecraft, Kenneth Grant, and the Typhonian Tradition in Magic in the show notes at vftb.net, View from the Bunker, vftb.net. Now, full disclosure, I'm re-recording the concluding remarks in this program. It is now February the 2nd of 2014, about a week and a half after I recorded the original conclusion to the program with Peter. And I'm doing this because I felt that the original conclusion to the show, the wrap-up, didn't quite summarize what I felt the important parts of the interview were. And so I wanted to give it another go. This is, I felt, one of the more important interviews that I've done over the 5 years or thereabouts that we've been producing View from the Bunker. And there were a couple of things I think I wanted to bring out and something I wanted to stress. And that is that the interview was for the purpose of drawing out information and better understanding certain connections in the spirit realm that we don't often hear discussed in our daily lives, certainly things that we don't often hear discussed in churches on Sunday, which we probably should. As Christians, by default, we believe in the supernatural, but we are not often instructed on how we should interpret our interactions with the supernatural realm and how we should go about, or whether we should go about interacting with the supernatural realm. You may be wondering, especially if you're a relatively new listener to the program, why I didn't, as a Bible-believing Christian, why I didn't challenge Peter on his statement that with proper preparation, purification, one can enter the spirit realm without fear and actually have a pleasant experience, as opposed to those reported by some of the participants in the DMT experiments of Dr. Rick Strassman, the experiences of those who report being abducted by what they believed to be extraterrestrials. As a Christian, I accept the biblical command of God delivered through Moses to avoid consulting with necromancers, in other words, summoning the dead, to avoid witchcraft and sorcery. And I believe that there are good reasons that God told the Hebrews not to engage in such practices. It is my belief that we were so instructed that that the spirit realm is essentially dangerous. And the reason, by the way, for the Apostle John's, I'd call it a command, I guess, to test the spirits, because not all are from God. And the analysis of the Apostle Paul, who said that although it may seem like our enemies are of flesh and blood, in fact, we are wrestling with supernatural intelligences, powers, principalities, thrones, dominions, rulers of spiritual darkness, and so forth. The Lord God, Yahweh, Jehovah, whatever you want to call him, the God of the Bible, made it pretty clear that he didn't want his people messing about with such things. It's pretty clear when you read The Dark Lord and in conversing with Peter, whom I like a great deal and whose research I respect a great deal, that his worldview is different. He sees differently on that particular perspective. We believed that that was his worldview even when we read the Sinister Forces trilogy, which in which he makes a very compelling case that the government of the United States, or at least elements within it, essentially sold its soul, its collective soul, to the devil in exchange for some knowledge about mind control techniques. In so doing, opening up certain portals or perhaps opening up certain unwitting participants in their experiments to the spirit realm, forces from the dark side, if you will, and engaging in some really evil stuff. By the time we get to book three, it was pretty clear that what Peter was arguing was that these guys didn't know what they were doing, and that we need to better understand how to engage the spirit realm properly in order to prevent evil things from coming through from the other side. So that is the position that I take on this, that we as Christians have been warned by God away from engaging with the spirit realm, and that if the spirit realm chooses to engage with us, we're to use discernment to the best of our ability. In other words, test the spirits to see if the message they're delivering to us is consistent with the message received from the Bible, the gospel message. And if it is not, then we are to reject that message because it is, well, from the other side, from the other, from the enemy. So as an interviewer, I tend not to be confrontational. Again, the point of the interview was not to engage in debate with Peter. Again, he's a careful researcher, and he reports honestly, I believe. And so his information is valuable, even if we draw different conclusions from it. I thought the key points, the takeaways from the interview, that we are in agreement that H.P. Lovecraft, that Aleister Crowley, Kenneth Grant, and perhaps other sensitives, to borrow a word, are hearing from the same supernatural source. The message is consistent, it is an anti-Christian message. As Peter pointed out during the interview, and I think this is key also, H.P. Lovecraft is, in his view, and I will defer to him as he spent a lot more time researching this than I have, it is Peter's view that H.P. Lovecraft is essentially the guy who kicked off the ancient aliens or ancient astronauts meme, that humanity was planted on planet Earth by an extraterrestrial race that may someday be returning or may already be here. That idea certainly has been mainstreamed over the last few years by the likes of Giorgio Tsoukalos, building on the work of Eric von Däniken and Zechariah Sitchin, among others. The idea is gaining traction with mainstream viewers, and we can see this in the research, sadly, of the Barna Group, which conducts pretty regular surveys of American Christians to determine what they believe and why. And when you compare that against surveys of Americans about what they believe about, for example, extraterrestrials, and we see that on average, your typical American is more likely to believe that Earth has been visited by extraterrestrials than to believe that God is real, or that Jesus was fully God and fully man, lived a sinless life, and was resurrected from the dead. That's kind of a disturbing thought. We are not really in any meaningful way a Christian nation anymore. And that's why we do what we do here at A View from the Bunker and on PID Radio. So again, those were the takeaways. The supernatural source of whatever was inspiring H.P. Lovecraft to write, the supernatural source that delivered the holy books to Aleister Crowley, upon which Kenneth Grant built and developed his style of ritual magic, were one and the same. And it is very likely the same supernatural source that is inspiring and helping to propagate the meme that ancient aliens, ancient astronauts, are responsible in one way or another for life on planet Earth. You also noticed just a couple of other points. The H.P. Lovecraft story, The Dunwich Horror, in which the daughter of the, I wouldn't call him the protagonist, but one of the main characters, Wilbur Wetley, is impregnated through some ritual by an extraterrestrial force and births a monster. Not all that different from what took place in the days leading up to the events recorded in chapter 6 of the book of Genesis, when the giants were born to human women after propagating or cohabitating with angels. So, interesting that that also comes out in the modern horror or the gothic horror of Lovecraft. So again, that's the takeaway from this particular interview, I think. And again, the source to give it a name is Set, or to use the ancient name, perhaps Shet or Shaitan or Satan. That for me, the takeaway. And again, important information. And we appreciate the work and the research of Peter Lavenda, and he will be back within a couple of months. We'll talk about his research into what really happened to Adolf Hitler after World War II. Now, since I've already recorded the interview with the one that follows this in the sequence at A View from the Bunker, that would be William Ramsey, regarding his book Abomination, dealing with the West Memphis Three. I can tell you that's another interview that you don't want to miss. It's an important one regarding a very disturbing event in American history from 1993, and some possible reasons why the three young men who were convicted of the crime initially are now walking the streets free today. Because, after all, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. Until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.